do see that they often begin with some statement of faith. So, and faith is I call it kind of spiritual optimism, is that there is a path, that we do have strengths and powers, and that we can cultivate our hearts and minds, that there is a spiritual dimension to life, that there are enlightened beings, whatever way you want to couch that. So if you couch it in Buddhist terms, you say there is a Buddha. Buddha realized enlightenment. Other beings have realized freedom and compassion and deep understanding. And that's a possibility I have. Without faith, the doubting, cynical mind easily gets in there, doesn't it? So if you don't have faith, you think, I'm never going to be able to do this. And what does it matter anyway? It's all a black hole at the end of it. And you know, you get kind of a negative, nihilistic view. A person like that, of course, has no hope. So faith is quite important. But it doesn't, it's not really belief. You know, belief for me is something, for me, belief is around intellect more. Like say, I believe in rebirth. But I don't know. If you tell me that you had a past life experience, I say, yeah, it makes sense. But I don't really know. So for me, that's kind of intellectual. But faith, like for me, is something of the heart. So when I'm practicing, if I have faith in, say, training the mind, something simple like that, I know that if I do certain kinds of activities, I'll get wholesome results. It comes from experience. You know, it comes from having done it, worked at it. But I know, having done it enough, I've got the faith just to keep at it, to persevere, to be patient, to not make excessive demands, to accept, you know, all these kinds of attitudes around. And that's the kind of faith. Just keep doing it. So faith, most traditions have some statement of faith. So like here, I did this Namo Tassa mantra, or we do the homage. But those are just the words and symbols of what faith should be as an, I think for me at least, an attitude of the heart. Right? What is it as a heartfelt thing? And if you see its opposite, cynicism, nihilism, hopelessness, I can't do this, despair. Now the interesting thing is to when you have despair, where is your faith? So if you've got a basis of practice, spiritual practice, and then despair or these really difficult mind states come up, if you have faith in the midst of that, you can go through it. It's kind of maybe a spiritual crisis, so you can go through it. If you have no faith, no practice, then they blow you away, and you need Valium or whatever you might need. You need to kind of get rid of them, hold them onto them for a while until you can deal with them. Sometimes you need to do that. So faith is, and we live in a non-faith culture. So we live in secular cultures that tend to be very analytical and critical and such like. Certainly, we have faith in maybe in science or bank accounts and Nortel and people have faith in limited stuff. But for faith, so what am I kind of rambling on here? But faith is what is it of the heart? You know, what is it as an aspect of the heart, not as a belief? So I think that comes partially from experience, partially through culture. So a person who comes from a traditional Buddhist culture tends to have more faith than a person who's just kind of beginning on a Buddhist path. But as I often say to people from traditional Buddhist cultures, the difficulty with faith is then it can go into blind belief. So I had an example in Thailand. An English woman was teaching English to a group of army cadets in the Dan Mueang airport there in Bangkok, outside Bangkok. And they were very, very kind of dutiful in the Thai way of always being dutiful to the professor. Anyone who's a professor should go to Thailand. Everyone obeys all the time. They don't argue about their marks or whatever. Anyway, she could see that actually they believed too much. So she started to actually write incorrect things on the board. And she knew that they knew that it was wrong, but they just copied it out. Because their attitude of faith was one of, you just follow the boss. You don't question. Yeah? So that sometimes in a faith culture, it can go into like superstition. So I know like in in Thailand, in the villages, there's a lot of superstition, all kinds of interesting superstitions, which in my mind would not even kind of go towards. Why would you want to believe that? You know? So my mind would tend to go to more to be critical or cynical, whereas maybe like in those village cultures, the people who have a lot of faith, but they also could be very, very superstitious. So it kind of depends on where you're at and what culture, many, many things. But faith is an aspect of life, of practice, is this willingness to persevere, and an underlying faith that there is enlightenment, I guess, in Buddhism, that there is a Buddha, that there are enlightened beings, that it's more than just, like Buddhism is more than just kind of feel good kind of thing. You know, there's a profound possibility. So then also most meditation techniques also begin with a kind of statement of love, like metta, of compassion. Because there's something about a heart which is open in that way that can apply itself, I think, better to a meditation object. So it's a kind of heartfelt feeling about the practice. It's not just a willful feeling. And that's one of the, I think, downfalls of meditation, is when people just try to dominate and control and get rid of and become. It lacks heart. And in monastic life, what I've seen is that monks dry up. They literally dry up. Because they can be very willful and very diligent and very good and very ascetic and very, very clever. Very, very clever. Always very clever. But dry up. Because the heart's not being engaged in the practice, I think. That's one thing I've noticed. So this kind of a practice does kind of engage your heart, doesn't it? Literally, at this kind of a level. So anything that reminds you of that, anything that opens to that, is very valuable, I should think. But to think that it's just the object that triggers the open heart makes you object dependent. And then when the object goes, you feel great, great grief and great loss. Obviously that happens, but it's not object dependent. It can be object triggered. Because it's something about our own hearts, it's this sense of openness and kindness and compassion. So much of Buddhism is encourages that, a lot of encouragement in that. And in the idea of training, if one sees that aspect is helpful, important, and one keeps doing it a lot, you do that a lot, like each meditation that you do, you start and you can do it for the whole meditation, you do it for 5-10 minutes, that becomes a strength. What we call like a paramita, a virtuous quality of the heart, which then just begins to click in. And this is how we say the practice clicks in. You hear that kind of language sometimes? Like if I've done practices of openness and receptivity and compassion and kindness, right? So, I've then maybe done that with not just images, I've began to apply that attitude to a painful knee. Because a painful knee is actually similar to maybe a sound that I don't like, something I don't want in my life. And I begin to apply that openness of heart, acceptance, compassion to something I dislike, like a painful knee. So you learn to do that in meditation with my body, discomfort. I mean, so come in, bring discomfort into my heart, and may you be well to the body, rather than, oh, damn pain, you know, it's half an hour to sit, just going to control the pain, I'm not going to move. There's 29 minutes left. Should I, you know, this whole kind of control scenario that we get into, it just, you welcome the pain. May you be well. You kind of have compassion for the body. May you be well. And you do that, you know, one does that with little things, like a painful knee or just some quirky mind state. One begins to apply this openness of heart as an aspect of awareness. Not just like a sort of dualistic, may I be well, may you be well. But actually much more profound, a quality of awareness and love together, an open kind of quality. And you begin to apply that to things like, yeah, just feeling grumpy. And just, oh, grumpy, come into my heart, grumpy. May you be well. And you can kind of get beyond just, oh God, there I'm going, I'm grumpy again, or just dumping it on whoever, right? Just, you know, you have love for grumpy. Oh, there's grumpy. Really, you know, you can play around like that. If you do all of that, and it sounds maybe, you know, not that serious. But if you actually do apply your heart that way, then when you get something really difficult, like despair or something really profound, then you've got this kind of equipment in place. You get a foundation. And oftentimes the really heavy stuff like that are the kind of, I think in modern parlance they call it spiritual crises. It's a kind of crisis of the heart, right? And rather than think that's, you know, like you've blown it, right, and it's bad, which is what we usually think, and everyone around us thinks, oh, get rid of that, that's bad, and no one wants it. But if one can enter into that with love, into those difficult, lonely, despairing kind of mind states, and welcome that into the heart, then there's a kind of breaking of the ego, because one no longer needs to even run away from that. One no longer needs to even figure that one out, analyze it, do something about it, get rid of it, distract it. It's just despair, the guy says. But one's willing to be open-hearted to despair, and there's a profound... And I mean, I've been through that, and in the literature I've read, my teachers have been through. There's something quite profound about that. And that's if you have a kind of spiritual practice going. If you don't have a spiritual practice, then it seems to be a failure, or, you know, one doesn't kind of go into it. Because it is very difficult. It is very, very moving in that way. But if one doesn't have the equipment, one might be able to sometimes, but quite often we just distract it and wait for a better day. So everything is important. You know, whether you have a kind of a bit of a pain in the knee or just a grumpy mind, or whether it's a really, really deep kind of experience of fear, whatever you're into, it's all very important, because the kind of easy, seemingly innocuous stuff gives you a chance to train, right? Gives you a chance to train. So if you have to train all the time, you know, it's not something you pick up and put down. You have to keep cultivating the heart. So if you do that, like you really apply yourself in that way, in a kind of daily way, you've got the stuff in place to deal with difficult karma. So the difficult karma comes up when there's great loss. So loss of my own health in some way, I have a stroke or break my back or something extreme, whatever, or someone dies, or you lose your job, you know, something really which you get kind of blindsided. And no one wants it, but it happens to a lot of us, right? And you know, I'm not wishing it on everyone, but there are ways of dealing with that. There are ways of being with that. And also, if one has dealt with those things oneself, maybe it's not that difficult, but one also has the right attitude to others, that we're not afraid of others' despair. We're not afraid of others' loneliness. We're not afraid of, you know, these things which happen in life. We have a way of really being with someone's despair, or really being with someone's loneliness or fear, because we haven't run away from it ourselves. And we see that as very, very important for the spiritual path, right? Rather than distracting, which is what most people do. And fair enough, that's what humans do. So the cultivation of the heart is very much blocked by the tendency to think and always try to figure things out. And one of the things I find myself recommending, because I do it a lot now, is to be more and more aware of the head as a physical experience, and to see how thought is up there, and to learn how to bring all that tension, bring it down, and really cultivate the heart. And really begin to receive life through the heart. Make that a training. Because in that particular way, it's much, much simpler. Because thought is very complex, isn't it? I was just contemplating how complex, like, let's say, it's Christmas today, isn't it? But it's not, it's the 21st of March. So it's just how we as human beings are very complex, how you might think it's very beautiful, or you might think, oh gosh, there's spring again. Why do I think like that? Well, because I have memory. So my memory says 21st of March, this isn't right, and so on and so forth. It was a bear kind of wakes up and goes back to sleep for another week. So we're very, very complex people, beings. We're very complex. So we have memory, we have thought, we have perception, we have judgments, and all of that. And I think one of the problems with Buddhism is it's very, very intellectual, kind of. What you read can be very, very intellectual. And very, very, it's good intellectual stuff, and we need to use that. But quite often I find people, and myself included, is trying to figure it out all the time. So you read some really clever bit of Buddhism, and then you try to get all these lists down, and you're going to get, it's absolutely daunting. Or you just get off on it all the time. You get off on the ideas. Whereas the heart's very simple. The heart's much, much more simple than thought. And I find that my own practice is the more I'm aware in the present moment, that's a given. You know, if you can't enter into the present moment and sustain the present moment, then you've got to work at that. And do it down here, then it becomes very simple. The heart's getting tense or the heart's relaxed? The heart's at ease or the heart's making a problem? And it can be fear, or it could be depression, or it can be anger, but it doesn't really matter, it's just the heart. And if you get something very simple like that, you've got a much more simple way of practicing with life as it presents itself. So whether I'm at a committee meeting, or I'm at a meditation retreat, or whatever, I'm aware of the heart. What's the heart doing now? And then someone praises me, and I think, yeah, you're right. And if someone blames me, you know what you're talking about. Or I say, yeah, you're right, you're absolutely right, I'm hopeless, you're right. Well, you know, whatever I do, what's the heart doing? And what's the head doing? And I think for me, that's important because I've come from a very sort of intellectual approach. I like thought, and I enjoy analysis and those kinds of things, but I have found that I don't have to figure the heart out. I can just feel it, and I can know it. And when it's getting tight, I can relax it by being with it. It's much more simple than trying to figure it out. Now, I've had to figure a certain amount of things out. So if you're looking at Buddhism as an attempt to get some experience, say, right, repeat some experience you've had, or get some kind of enlightenment experience you read about, then you feel frustrated mostly, and you get the experience once every 5 years maybe. But basically you just feel frustrated because you're trying to get something which the books say you should get, or that you did have, but you're not really with life. You're with memory. You're with a memory. Or if you're trying to figure out this moment in some perceptual, conceptual way from a book you've read, you know, if you read this, this, oh, is this stage, or is that, you're not with life, you're with the thought, you're with memory. But the moment isn't a memory, is it? It's just this way. So this is what we're always trying to train in. We're just trying to train in the very simple pure presence, we call it, pure presence. And pure presence is actually the most mysterious. So like one of the questions that gets asked a lot for nowadays is, what is spirituality? Because much of Western culture has kind of chucked out institutional religion. I'm a kind of anachronism, I think. Kind of a holdout. Or, you know, God got chucked out by Nietzsche, probably, or whatever. And so, like, but yet people still, spirituality is still something. And yet, you ask them, what's spirituality? People, well, it's God. I don't believe in God. Well, what is it? What is spirituality? What is that word? It's compassion. Yeah, well, maybe. But what is spirituality? What do you mean? And it's a kind of word that gets bandied around now. It's kind of seemed to be important, but what is it? So if you're not into a kind of theistic mode, and I'm not kind of, like, the word God doesn't really do much for me. So I'm not pro-God or anti-God, you know. it's not a word that has much meaning for me. So I think in Buddhism, what spirituality actually is presence. Now, usually we are occupied with the objects of what we're into. So, like you feel angry, so you're preoccupied with anger. Or you got a new computer, you get preoccupied with your new computer. Or you have doubt, preoccupied with doubt. Or it's snowing, preoccupied with the ice, so you don't break your back. or it's spring, oh, it's lovely. So there's all these experiences we have of coldness and heat and memory and joy and sorrow, and we're continually preoccupied with that. We tend to be preoccupied. But what is it that makes that possible? And it's presence, or awareness, or being, or knowing, or whatever you want to call it. And that the mystery of that is that you can't label it. You know, you can't. You can know you feel. Like right now, I feel warm. But that which tells me that I'm here now, I can't. That has got no flavor, does it? Has no flavor. It's the mystery, right? And for me, what the spiritual practice is doing is taking to the mystery of presence. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, but I'll go for it. Why not? We say awareness is the path to the deathless, if you get canonical, if you're into Theravada, right? Awareness is the path to the deathless, awareness, presence. And if you look at what your attention always gets drawn by pleasure and pain. So, you know, you're sitting there, and, you know, you've sat for 15 minutes, and then your back starts to hurt. You get drawn by the pain, don't you? Your attention goes to the pain. And then we start to get preoccupied with the back. Just a little bit more. Just adjust it a bit, right? And you try to get it so it's pain-free. And then you say, no, I'm not going to move. And then we just try to dominate the pain. So only a half hour left. You'll survive, a half hour left. But we're constantly preoccupied with that, right? Or we get some really lovely meditative experience. We really kind of floating feelings. Sometimes you sit there and your body feels like 10 foot tall. And you're, oh, it's 10 foot tall, I've got it now. I got the 10 foot tall feeling. But it's just a 10 foot tall feeling. Right? And you get preoccupied with the 10 foot tall feeling. But through all of that, there's presence. And that presence is very mysterious. It has no quality, taste. You can only be it. This is the way we talk. Be present. Well, of course you can be present. I'm not going to be absent. So it sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook, right? But I think for me, what the spiritual life is in Buddhism, the way we talk about it, is the khandhas, the five khandhas, or which we call the psychophysical experience, or mind-body experience of thoughts and bodily feelings and emotions and memories and all of that changes, right? Coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. And desire, craving, is that which is always trying to get it right. Get it happy and keep it from getting unhappy. So attention then is preoccupied with desire. Desire to get it right, make it happy, get it comfortable, keep it interested, at least keep it healthy, keep it, you know, active, whatever. And then fighting off, don't let it be depressed, you know, the fear. So there's this continual kind of struggle with that which changes. Thoughts and bodily feelings and all of that. It's just kind of preoccupation. And the Buddha says, it's a red herring. You're looking in the wrong place. It's not what you know, don't worry about it. Let go. So the worldly attitude is always trying to get it right. And the Buddha says, you won't ever get it right. You get it nice, but then it'll change, and then you'll be preoccupied again. So you'll get the 10-foot feeling, okay, but then tomorrow, when you get the 1-foot feeling, you'll try to get the 10-foot feeling, and you'll be preoccupied. So the Buddha says, stop. Stop. Just stop and look at the way things are. Accept. Let go of craving. Abandon craving. Let it go and see what happens. And in when you start to abandon craving and you really just accept the way things are, you begin to sense that that presence is actually deeply silent. It's not that you're silent, it's just there is this silent knowing, silent presence. And then you get curious and you kind of turn the mind, we call it turning the mind on the mind. You begin to contemplate the very nature of awareness. Well, who's contemplating the nature of awareness? You just begin to be aware of awareness, know the knowing. And I mean, those, I mean, it might sound like gobbledygook again, but what is spirituality? Is it just love? Does that mean that all the other things aren't? Is it just a dualistic thing? Do I have to get rid of all the negative things and get the positive things? Is that what it's about? Tiresome, isn't it? But it's deeper than that. It has to be deeper than that. Because it's not about anything that changes. We say, like in Buddhism, we say there is the deathless, there is the unchanging, there is the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, there is Nibbana. We keep talking about that. And even the feeling of love changes. So why do we do open-hearted practices? It's because it's not an end in itself, but it's the end of preoccupation with aversion. It keeps you present. It's a way of staying present. Staying present. Awakening the mind. So ultimately what you have to get to is like, and you can do that, let's say if you're sitting and you have discomfort. You begin to just know discomfort, and what's more important is that the discomfort points to your presence. And the worldly goes the other way around. It's always looking at the discomfort. It's the opposite. Your fear points to your presence, as does joy. Because they can only be possible if there's presence. They can't exist without presence, without awareness, without being, whatever you want to call it. So it's like, it's very subtle. It's very different from the worldly project. The worldly project is to get happy. And I do that. You know? I had a coffee before I came, that's why I can blather on so much. Right? But I know coffee's not spiritual, even though it is, you know, it's a good coffee. I know that. Or food, or music, or whatever. That's not bad. But if that is what I think spirituality is, then I'm always going to be disappointed. Because I'll be looking in the wrong place. But if I just dismiss, and this has been probably the bane of religion, where it's dismissed the sensual world as being bad or wrong, then I'm still preoccupied. Right? Then that's repression. It's still a problem. So if some kind of mind state comes up and I want to kind of, you know, murder someone, that's just a feeling of wanting to murder someone. Morally, I don't do it. But if I keep getting preoccupied with it, make it a problem. Just don't murder anyone. It's just a feeling of murderous feeling. I've never had that. We had one. A woman came to the monastery in London, phoned up Dr. Ajahn Sumedho, said, "I have to speak with you right away." And what's the problem? And she said, I got to speak. We didn't know who she was. She had heard about us. Came to the monastery. And he said, "What is it?" We thought she'd just gunned someone down or something. "I'm a terrible person, I'm an awful person." "Why?" "Well, my daughter just gave birth to a child. And I took the child in my arm and had this thought that I want to poke the baby's eyes out." Gave the baby back and I ran away. That was 6 months ago. "I'm a terrible person." And Ajahn Sumedho asked, "Well, did you do it?" And she said, "Of course not." I said, "What's the problem?" She was preoccupied with memory. She was preoccupied with the khandhas, as we say, you know, in Theravada Buddhism. And it's this preoccupation with guilt. So, you know, I did something 5 years ago and it was a bad move. Okay, it was a bad move. And maybe I've apologized or whatever and I've paid my dues. And then the memory comes up. And rather than seeing the memory as a memory, I get preoccupied. "You're terrible, Viradhammo. You're terrible, you're terrible, you're terrible, you're terrible, bad, 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 bad." And then someone says, "No, you're good, good, good." Then I say, "I'm good, 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 good." Still preoccupied. Presence is neither good nor bad. Huh? See, so like the religious life is going beyond duality. You know, it's not just becoming a good person. But being a good person is very helpful. Because it tends to calm the mind. It tends to make the heart happy. It's not remorseful. But goodness in itself is not the goal. It's the path. Right? So doing good works and living a moral life and being generous and being loving are all very, very, very important things in the spiritual path. But if, you know, the essence, it's more subtle than that. It's more deep than that. It's kind of interesting. And to do this kind of investigation of presence, as it were, you have to be quite quiet, don't you? If your mind's kind of chopping away and analyzing, then you've got to settle it down. So much of meditation is settling it all down. doing breath practice, doing heart practice, or doing walking meditation, or doing some hatha yoga or qigong or whatever you want, and getting it all settled down, getting it into the moment, getting it composed and getting it quiet. But then you have to let go of desire. You have to kind of just let it be. And then what you find is that desire will come up, craving. Is this presence? Is this right now? And you start to look for something that's right. And you won't see, well, that's just a doubt. And you start to get preoccupied with doubt. Have I got it now? Do I know what he's talking about? You're preoccupied with thought. So it's this kind of, what the Buddha's pointing to is preoccupation, which we call attachment. Attachment's not a good word. Why did I use it? Yeah. what I like to play around is with language and keep reinventing language, because like attachment sounds like, I think it's got a bad reputation, but preoccupation? There's a difference between just knowing and being and accepting the feeling of discomfort and being preoccupied with it. Either as a repressive kind of thing, I'm not going to move now, or I'm moving, you know. There's a difference, isn't there? When it's either negative or positive, it's preoccupation. But just the pure knowing, pure presence. We say pure presence is always transcending. And if you can be with like a bodily pain and just practice pure acceptance, deep presence, you'll find that it has a whole different quality. It's not you, it's just something in consciousness. It has a whole different quality because it's not invested with a strong sense of me getting rid of or doing. And that's where the teachings around anatta come, not self. It's not self doesn't mean that it's some vacuum, but it's this sense of always being preoccupied and trying to control and trying to get rid of, a strong sense of me. And so if you find that in your meditation, a strong sense of me doing something to become something or someone, that's the preoccupation. But if you do meditation just for presence, so if you use breath just to be present, because that's something that's present, so you're just with the breath, then what you're cultivating is presence. Or you just walk up and down, present. Huh? Presence, presence, presence. And that's not a practice on greed, it's a practice of being. And then if you get a feeling for that with the breath, then you can start to do it with like fear, or those difficult things that really preoccupy us. You know, fear really preoccupies, anxiety really preoccupies us. Whatever, we begin to say, oh, that's just fear. And there's a pure acceptance of fear. And the more you do that, fear points to pure presence, as does joy. It's the other way around. Different. Yeah? Okay, I'll leave that for you. Try that one. Too much coffee in it. Any questions for anyone? Yeah, what that means becomes more and more profound. More timeless, less sense of a self in it, deep love, those kinds of things. But it can't be entered into through time. In other words, you can't do it now to get it later. And what you notice, desire is always in time. I'm doing this now to get something later. And this is timeless. So it's like the whole Buddhist practice is always like desirelessness, emptiness. It's got a whole different language. And that's where trust and faith are. Whereas desire is not trusting. It's, you know, it's trying to control and get rid of it, whatever. So just allowing, it's very hard to do actually, because desire is this powerful energy of rebirth. So in the beginning it doesn't seem like one is ever present. You know, like when I started, you know, when I started, I remember I read a book on the psychology of awareness, and it really made a lot of sense. It was in university, and I noticed myself surfacing every 3 or 4 months. I kind of noticed it was going down, and I just plunged back into kind of being totally lost. So that sense of presence, I think what happens is it's a change of identity. It's a change from identifying with that which moves to realizing that which knows is your real home. And the kind of worldly mind is always identifying with it. Like just say, when you begin to notice anger as an object of mind rather than being angry, you change your identity, don't you? It's more and more that kind of a movement. So just to say that, like, awareness is the ultimate aim could make it sound very shallow. There's a profundity and a depth in that kind of silence. But it's entered into through waiting rather than becoming. It's a different, subtle kind of thing. Yeah? Yeah.
Is there something after presence?
I haven't discovered anything after or before, or if it's timeless. To presence. Yeah, yeah. It's coming home. Yeah, yeah, who you really are. But even that, saying who you really are, kind of can imply a me and a self and so on. So in Theravada language, we kind of just... the way we approach it is by letting go of the desire to become something or get rid of something. But yeah, that's the spirit of it. So the more there is abiding in presence, the more one is touching your real home, as it were. I hope this isn't gobbledygook. Good fun.
But then that ties into the reincarnation.
Well, the point of Buddhism is not to get recycled.
Right.
Right? So it doesn't tie into it. That's the whole point of it. And that's often forgotten in traditional cultures, is that, you know, everyone's trying to get a good retake. whereas truly what the Buddha realized was the deathless. But it's, when you say deathless, it sounds like me perpetuating myself forever, which would be really boring. It's not like a me at infinitum or ad nauseum, whatever, but it's either a whole different dimension that the Buddha realized. And to enter into that is a kind of, it's just like the Buddha, apparently he kind of, you know, he had his realization and he thought, this is too subtle, no one's going to understand this, because people are addicted to sense consciousness, they just love it so much, or so preoccupied with it. He didn't quite say it this way, but so like in the beginning in the text say there was a doubt, why teach, it's just going to be a hassle. And then something arose in consciousness which said, well, there are those who have little dust in their eyes. So teach for those who have little dust in their eyes. Because it's very subtle, that. This kind of change of identity. If one can even say it that way. Yeah, you according to your character. So like some people are, like I'm not a very visual person, so I don't do visualization. Some people do, so I never teach them because I don't do them. But some people are very good at visualizations, and they find that a very calming way of bringing up imagery, and then they, you know, do it, teach it, and so on. So it's a matter of character. But if you understand the principles of what we're looking for, we're not looking for a particular kind of experience, we're trying to sustain presence, then, you know, your experiment will be based on right understanding. But if you're just trying to get a particular kind of experience, then it can be conjoined with a lot of desire and frustration. So I always try to... I remember when I studied engineering, the best guy in the class, he never cranked out formula. He always took any problem from basic principles. And I just tried to, I don't know what I did in university, actually. but I really remember that, because he always understood the problem, right? So if you understand what the project is like I like to say, then whatever you pick up from whatever tradition, you know, whether it's a Christian practice, Sufi practice, or Buddhist practice, you're basing your investigation and practice on right view. So Buddhism always, you know, always emphasizes that right understanding, right view. And then it's up to you to be creative enough to find the types of practices which facilitate presence and awareness. Yeah, go on.
Is there a sense in which you're relaxing into the presence that is?
Yeah. Ease of being. Yeah. Rather than trying to get...
Yes.
It's that. That's why I like to... Yeah, that's exactly. Because that's what... Like, who was it? Someone told me, I've been doing this for 20 years and it doesn't work. And I said, well, what have you been doing? They aren't doing what I'm doing. And I think what, for me, it was the word I started to use was receptivity. You know, that's why I started to throw out words like awareness, because awareness was conjoined with control. I have to be present, and, you know, I can't drop any rice from my spoon, and, you know, all kinds of little Mickey Mouse practices that monks do. And it was all just this kind of control, and I hated it. And, you know, it started to dry up. And then I began to see that, you know, that's why I think metta, even metta can be used as an attempt to be loving.
Just accepting loving.
Yeah. So if you can get that, so my, you know, that's like some of the language I use around that is receptivity. Let it come to you. It depends on how you perceive words. Words are just, you know, they're just perception. It's how you plug into that basic idea. Mm. I used ease of being for a couple of years. That was very good for me. What do I use now? Coffee. I spoke with you earlier. I use acceptance a lot now. It's a word that's strong for me. Yeah, but that's the spirit. Yeah. Yes.
You talked about the importance of faith. Can one do something to strengthen one's faith?
What I do is I read about spiritual beings. You know, like, I read a fantastic book about Ramakrishna by Lex Hickson. It's a beautiful take on him. Or I read of famous Thai teachers. And that always gives me great... I've just read a lovely biography of St. Francis. Or read the life of the Buddha again. You know, those things really uplift my heart. Yeah, you know, there is realization. And I've also, I mean, I can cast back to my own experience. It's not that I'm enlightened, but I've got enough meditative experiences to have a lot of confidence that way. In the early days, I had a very good teacher. You know, so I, you know, went through a lot of difficulties, but the teacher was just so inspiring. That helped a lot. His encouragement, but it's just his being, that helped a lot. So any images which would bring up that possibility would be helpful. So like literature, which is very, you know, like just kind of following the developments of the Mideast crisis, is pretty depressing. You know, that's not going to bring much faith. So a certain amount of political information is fine, but if you're always getting that impact and you're not getting the other, then you have to pump up the other, as it were. But that's my way. I love to read about saints. But I was very fortunate to have a good teacher. It's not that he was always nice to me. He certainly gave me a tough time. But that was part of the game. You see, his methodology, I often say this, when he asked, what's the technique you teach? He'd say, I teach frustration. he was very good at it. Shall we? Ah, yes, Emily. Well, you have to answer that for yourself. Did you live today? Well, I don't know. I can't read your mind.
For the moment, we can describe that as the real living.
I would. Yeah, I would. But which doesn't, you know, you can still think about the future as long as you're thinking in the present. And like you're actually aware of thought. But you know, amazing how people can drive a car and get to their destination and not really remember the road. You know, planned it. So, yeah, that's what real life would be. This kind of timeless presence. Which again, it's not like Don saying, it's not like you're just trying to be present. But it's more like, this is the way it is now. It's more like that, so, rather than, I'm not going to let my, I'm going to drive to work and I'm going to be aware of every second. Which is, you probably have an accident.
Yes.
It depends on the person, but I mean, I've never had that kind of pain.
I went to Timbuktu. I go around catching. Also, to my Loma, which is really easy. It's a choice between how much you spend and the value. It really becomes profound when you're faced with where your mind goes. Does it go to fear? Does it give you comfort?
What did you do? So what did you do?